and energy, debating whether kiot or and phlegetanus are real or fictitious. What in the hell does that mean? Well, I couldn't expect you to know if you weren't listening last night about 1:30 in the morning. I'm reading from Holy Blood, Holy Grail, Bajent Lee and Lincoln. Having failed to isolate the secret that was discovered by the priest that was obviously in the possession of the Priory de Sion, this secret society that's exercised such power since the First Crusade, clear up to the present day, an influence in Europe, these writers have turned out of this thing. That's known as pent-up energy. These writers, are you going to be in the King's House Sunday?
Yes,
I know what most of you did last Sunday. You said he's making such a big thing out of it, the place will be packed out and I won't be missed. And a third of you said that. And you better be there Sunday. Well, I don't preach. Number two, special announcement. Don't count me out in Los Angeles. I mean, in San Francisco. We got an order to shut down at 12:01 midnight, January 2nd. That means we will be broadcasting on Channel 38, on New Year's Day, an alternative to the Rose Parade and the ball games, what a cruel thing to do. You ought to be able to give your crew the day off on New Year's Day. But by a sadistic urge of insanity, those duckheads ordered us to shut down at 12:01 midnight, January 2nd, the end of New Year's Day. Now, I will make you a bet that you will be looking at me at 12:02, 12:03, 12:04, 12:05, 12:06, 12:07, 12:08, 12:09, 12:10, 12:11. By then we will have passed the amount the duckheads can count, and I'll make you bet we'll still be going. We'll bet. Number three, special announcement. We're going to South France next fall. Number four, remember we had a New Year's Eve party planned at the secret place for $1,000. Well, we run into problems. New Year's Eve, in the place it's planned is in Pasadena area, and Pasadena is insane on New Year's Eve. You can't even cross streets. That's just simple reality. So I have decided to have the party on Friday night January 31st. We will call it the end of the beginning of 1986 party. The end of the beginning of 1986. The last day of the first month. Now, I think you would rather... I don't think New Year's Eve's that big a deal. And Friday night's a good night to have it, and the 31st of January happens to be on Friday night. So you that are making the reservations for $1,000 a plate, it's not going to be a great big eating feat because it's at the secret place and we have things to show you. I think I'll just have the fanciest hors d'oeuvres and light fare from one of the... Well, we'll see. But it's the 31st of January. It hasn't been abandoned. I mean, I really don't want some of you to get caught in the Rose Parade trying to come to my party and at about noon, New Year's Day, you finally get off of the road and the cops let you turn right or left. Or some of you will come to the party and end up out in the Pacific. I don't want to be near Pasadena on New Year's Eve. People who live there have to get a pass to go to their own home. Special announcement number 5. I'm ready to teach now. Having sought in normal history, that's interesting, try to crack under your glasses and not poke your cigar in your eye. Having searched through ordinary, regular, factual, mundane, routine, boring history for the secret, these writers finally decided to turn to the Grail romances that began to have such a profound influence in Europe in the 12th century. Now, most people in America grew up knowing a little bit about King Arthur, the Knights of the Round Table, the pursuit of the Holy Grail. But those Grail stories also circulated in a much more mystical form on the continent, not just in Britain. And in those mysteries, as with art and with legends, they sometimes become a secret means of communicating truths and ideas or concepts or secrets known to the few who know how to read it. We saw that the paintings of Nicholas Poussin were designed to communicate things to those that knew how to read the symbols, as well as being art appreciated for art's sake. The essence of what these writers are now going to do is search the Grail romances and seek support for a theory that they have and possible links between the Grail romances and this secret society in its nature that we've been studying throughout this book. We're on page 265 of Holy Blood, Holy Grail, Bajan Lee and Lincoln. I want to finish it because we are going to the south of France and we need to have it covered before I get there. Among other things, we will go to Rennes-le-Château. We'll visit vineyards. And we will study the earliest church history from the work of Lazarus as the first bishop of Marseille, to the household of Bethany and others closest to Jesus from in and around the Capernaum area who settled in and evangelized the southern valleys of France long before Rome even had a church in the house. We looked at 3 different Grail romance writers. We're now looking at the 4th one. that fourth one is by Wolfram von Eschenbach, Parseval. He claims that the information he got for his Grail story came from one Kiot of Provence, who in turn supposedly received it from one Flegetanus. And we read a long quote in which he gives credit to these two predecessors as the source of his story. And at that point, I quit, and here we are. That had an adequate review?
Yes,
scholars have wasted considerable time and energy debating whether Kiot and Flagitanus are real or fictitious. Now, I can continue from that point, can I? And I don't have to review when we join the next bunch. But maybe you don't even want me to teach on this tonight. And I ain't too happy with the way you're treating our budget. We're getting about $19,000, $20,000 a day. We need $33,000 a day to even make a million. So can you sort of reach around, kick yourself, and get on the telephone, tell me what you're going to do, and take the next 4 minutes, and right after the head revolves? I mean, haven't you drawn any connection between the opening of our program and the object of worship among the Templars? Where is everybody tonight? One long night wears them all out. I just got a church full of wimps. There are a few of us iron-souled ones here, but the rest of them are a bunch of wimps. Where are the voices of faith tonight? Shoot a cannon over that direction, you could kill 14 phones and not hit a person. Now get on the telephone and tell me it's not going to be like this Sunday. I hate Christmas, this heathen festival. I hate it. Scholars have wasted considerable time and energy trying to light cigars. Now, if you give me cigars for Christmas, make sure they're either Davidoff Zeno's or Calixto Lopez Philippine, because I'm equally good. Because I'll take some Louis XIII cognac and some 1955 port. That's for those that want to know. Don't send me no ripple. Send that to Jimmy Swaggart. Don't waste good stuff on him. He wouldn't touch it. South of France turns me on. I don't know if we're going to get to Rome or not. Scholars have wasted considerable time and energy debating whether Kiot and Flagitanus are real or fictitious. In fact, the identity of Kiot, as we had learned from our study of the Templars, can be fairly solidly established. Kiot de Provence would seem almost certainly to have been Guyot de Provines, a troubadour, monk, and spokesman for the Templars who did live in Provence and who wrote love songs, attacks on the church, praise of the temple, and satirical verses. Guyot is said to have visited Mayence in Germany in 1184. The occasion was the chivalric festival of Pentecost, at which the Holy Roman Emperor, Frederick Barbarossa, conferred knighthood on his sons. As a matter of course, the ceremony was attended by poets and troubadours from all over Christendom. As a knight of the Holy Roman Empire, Wolfram von Eschenbach, we're, to those that just joined us, in Holy Blood, Holy Grail, page 265, reviewing it. They're now looking at the Grail romances to see if they hold a clue to what the secret was. We've looked at three romances. Now we're looking at Wolfram von Eschenbach, who claims he got it from Keot and Flagitanus. Are they historic personages? And that's what they're attempting to prove. As a knight of the Holy Roman Empire, Wolfram would almost certainly have been present. This bore you? And it is certainly reasonable to suppose that he and Guyot met. Learned men were not so very common at that time. They ain't common at any time. Inevitably, they would have clustered together, sought each other out, made each other's acquaintance, and Guyot may well have found in Wolfram a kindred spirit to whom he perhaps confided certain information, even if only in symbolic form. And if Guyot permits Keot to be accepted as genuine or as one and the same, it is at least plausible to assume then that Flegetanus was genuine as well. If he was not, Wolfram and or Guyot must have had some special purpose in creating him and in giving him the distinctive background and pedigree he is said to have had. On his father's side, he was a heathen. On his mother's side, he was descended from Solomon, a Judaic. That was the claim. In addition to the Grail story, Wolfram may have obtained from Guyot a consuming interest in the Templars. In any case, are you interested in this at all?
Yes, sir.
Oh, you find out you can't just read it for yourself?
Yes, sir.
You know, I can read most of it and I can do it, but ever so often we come to some little intricate passage. We've got to sort it out. In any case, it is known that Wolfram possessed such an interest, that is, an interest in the Templars. Like Guyot, he even made a pilgrimage to the Holy Land, where he could observe the Templars in action at first hand. And in Parzival, he emphasizes that the guardians of the Grail and the Grail family are Templars. This might, of course, be sloppy chronology and cavalier anachronism of poetic license, such as can be discerned in some of the other Grail romances. But Wolfram is much more careful about such things than other writers of his time. Moreover, there are patent allusions to the temple in the Perlisvaus. Would both Wolfram and the author of the Perlisvaus be guilty of the same glaring anachronism? Possibly. But it's also possible that something is being implied by these ostentatious connections of the Templars with the Grail. For if the Templars are indeed guardians of the Grail, there is one flagrant implication that the Grail existed not only in Arthurian times, but also during the Crusades, when the romances about it were being composed. Now, we've got these authors again. They set out with saying the Grail had a pagan origin, that it was Christianized in the 12th century. Now they're reversing themselves and arguing that the Grail existed both in Arthurian times, which is between 5 and 7 generations from Joseph of Arimathea, as well as existing in the 12th century. And they've already admitted the legend that the Grail came with Mary Magdalene, legends dating back to the 4th century. A happening occurring within 5 years of the death and resurrection of Christ. Got to watch them. They're great. They're great historians. They could have used some the class logic with me. By introducing the Templars, both Wolfram and the author of the Perlusvaus, one of the three earlier romances we looked at, may be suggesting that the Grail was not just something of the past, but also something which, for them, possessed contemporary relevance. The background to Wolfram's poem is thus as important in some obscure way as the text of the poem itself. Indeed, the role of the Templars, like the identity of both Quixote and Plagiatenus, would seem to be crucial. And these factors may well hold the key to the whole mystery surrounding the Grail. Ah, that mystery interests me. Interests you? Really?
Yes, sir.
Well, I kept at it till 1:30 in the morning last night and eliminated half the crowd. Are you really interested, or are you just putting me on? I can read faster if I don't have to read aloud. The background thus is as important as the text of the poem itself. Indeed, the role of the Templars, like the identity of both Quixote and Plagiatenus, would seem to be crucial, and these factors may well hold the key to the whole mystery surrounding the Grail. Unfortunately, setting this up for something. The text of Parzival does little to resolve these questions while posing a good many others. Damn it, all we get is questions and dangling. There you go, putting your rear end between me and my people again. In the first place, Wolfram not only maintains that his version of the Grail story, in contrast to Creechin's, is the correct one, he also maintains that Creechin's account is merely fantastic fable, whereas his is in fact a species of, quote, initiation document, end quote. Okay, scratch Creechin. In other words, as Wolfram states quite unequivocally, there is more to the Grail mystery than meets the eye. That's pretty apparent, isn't it? That's an understatement of the year. And he makes it clear with numerous references throughout his poem that the Grail is not merely an object of gratuitous mystification and fantasy, but a means of concealing something of immense consequence. So, like a mask. Like a parable that Jesus would tell. Because he didn't want some people to hear and understand. Again and again, he intimates to his audience to read between the lines, dropping here, dropping there, suggestive hints. Now, don't you think you'll be a little smarter studying a little bit about the Grail than you would be if you wouldn't? It's like I sometimes write on something to someone, just remember when you get where you're going, you'll be there. That'll hit you after a while. At the same time, Wolfram constantly reiterates the urgency of secrecy. Quote, "For no man can ever win the grail unless he is known in heaven and he be called by name to the grail." End quote. And, he says, quote, "The grail is unknown save to those who have been called by name to the grail's company." So the Holy Grail, he's intimating, is like the parables of Jesus, a means of communication that to the uninitiated and those who don't know its key becomes a cloud, unintelligible, keeping them from understanding. And to those that are the initiates, a select few who know the key or the clue, it becomes a means of communication. It uncovers to some, covers to others, just like a parable. Wolfram is both precise and elusive in identifying the grail. When it first appears on Parzival's sojourn in the Fisher King's castle, there is no real indication of what it is. It would seem, however, to have something in common with Creechin's vague description of it. Quote, from Wolfram, "She," that is, the queen of the Grail family, "why don't you sit down there and lean on this other part of it? Then you won't be in front of the voice of faith the whole time. Just sit down. Move the microphone out of the way. You're not going to sing. Just roll it all the way around. Just push the microphone. Just reach right out and grab hold of it and turn it all the way around. Get it out of the way." Quote, "She," "the queen of the Grail family, was clothed in a dress of Arabian silk. Upon a deep green akhmadi." The hell is that? Huh? "She bore the perfection of paradise, both root." Let's start all over again. "She, the queen of the Grail family, was clothed in a dress of Arabian silk. Upon a deep green akhmadi," whatever the hell that is, must be something green. "Upon a deep green akhmadi, she bore the perfection of paradise, both root and branch." Whatever the hell the perfection of paradise is. "Born upon a deep green akhmadi by the queen dressed in Arabian silk. It was both root and branch. That was a thing called the Grail. A soul which surpasses all earthly perfection. Repent." Now here we go with dead gum. "Repent. The Shawi," whatever it is, "was the name of her whom the Grail permitted to be its bearer." I don't care what her name is. Call her abroad. It's the Grail I'm interested in. "Such was the nature of the Grail that she who watched over it had to preserve her purity and renounce all falsity." woman. We won't call her abroad. A good broad. Among other things, that's the end of the quote. Among other things, the Grail at this point would seem to be a kind of magical cornucopia or horn of plenty. Quote. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
They're boring me. I want them to get to it. Quote. 100 squires, so ordered, reverently took bread in white napkins from before the Grail, stepped back in a group, and separating, passed the bread to all the tables. I was told, and I tell you too, but on your oath, not mine, hence if I deceive you, we are liars, all of us, that whatsoever one reached out his hand for, he found it ready in front of the Grail, food warm or food cold, dishes new or old, meat tame or game. There never was anything like that, many will say. But they will be wrong in their angry protest, for the Grail was full of blessedness, such abundance of the sweetness.